Piano Jazz is made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Joseph Drown Foundation, the Baldwin Piano Company, Borders Books and Music, the Friends of Piano Jazz, and NBR. On this edition of Piano Jazz with Marion McParland, we delve into our archives to pay tribute to cornetist, jazz historian, and author Richard Sudhalter, who passed away in September 2008. Richard was a great friend of Marion and a Piano Jazz guest on several occasions. In this program from spring of 2000, Marion and Richard celebrate the life and music of Bix Beiderbecke, about whom he wrote a book entitled Bix, Man and Legend.
Rich, it's great to see you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and of course anything that has to do with Bix is just fine with me. He was the original inspiration for my entry into the jazz business and has been for many, many people throughout the years.
When did you write that landmark book, Bix, Man and Legend? It was a big book.
A little before our time. That was, you know, do you realize it was a quarter century ago, in 1974.
Wow. Because I got a lot of information about Bix from that, but mostly from Jimmy, as you can imagine. Jimmy, my husband, having replaced Bix in the Wolverines, and he always had these little tidbits to tell me about what Bix said to him. And, you know,
well,
it's just...
He was, after all, Bix's major admirer and acolyte and a good friend as well. So that I think Bix remained a bright and guiding star for him throughout his entire career.
You know, when I think about it, Bix was with so many different bands in his short life, and we're still hearing like those little gems that he did with, for instance, Paul Whiteman's band. How long was he with that band?
He was with Whiteman actually only for a couple of years. Before that, he was with the very famous Gene Goldkett Orchestra in Detroit. He spent about a year and a half with them, and it was with those two groups that I think his reputation spread as widely as it was going to be able to do in those days.
It's sort of funny to me that Paul Whiteman was known as the King of Jazz.
Well, it's not so surprising when you think that the public understanding of the word jazz in the 20s was any popular music that was peppy enough to dance to and anything surrounding that. The idea of what we later came to call jazz was not something that the general public even knew anything about. Musicians in the know called it hot music or just hot. If a dance band played at a ballroom, you'd say, who plays the hot? Who's the hot soloist?
Oh, who's the hot soloist? Yeah, right.
And it was that sort of thing, so the musicians knew who the guys were. But if somebody in an F. Scott Fitzgerald piece talked about the jazz age and, you know, the jazz craze, this was not really necessarily anything to do with the music itself. So, you know, somebody suggested once that a better title for Whiteman would have been King of the Jazz Age.
I guess it might have been. You know what's wonderful? That we're going to play some of the things that Bix liked to play, and we've got some great musicians here as well as you. We've got Howard Alden on guitar and Bill Crow on bass to do the music proud. And I would love to hear us play some of it. So what do you say we kick off one of the good old tunes?
Well, especially one that Bix liked well enough to have recorded twice with the Wolverines in 1924 and again with his own gang 3 years later in 1927. That's the Jazz Me Blues.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
I really love that sort of relaxed, easygoing tempo.
Well, in a certain way, you know, that's part of what Bix brought into the jazz vocabulary. Before he came along, most hot jazz was dedicated to the very idea of being hot, you know, cranking, ratcheting up intensity. And the emotional arc of a solo was, you know, pretty monolithic, you know, it was like an operatic aria. But all of a sudden, in this new approach, you had complexity, you had emotional layering, you had relaxation, you had what in an age long after that would be called cool.
Because, I suppose so, yeah, you know, when you think about it.
Yeah, because it had a little bit of detachment, but it was no less emotionally powerful for the kind of restraint that it brought. And I attribute that to Bix and his circle of immediate musicians.
I was just going to ask you who you thought was the brains behind setting a tempo like that, just the general feeling. You think it was Bix?
I think so. Oh, sure. From everything anybody ever said to me, he had an innate feeling for tempo and the character of the song and the way it would come out best. And I see no reason to doubt that.
Now, where did he get started? Lake Forest Academy he went to, didn't he?
Well, no, he was born and brought up in Davenport, Iowa, which at that point was a very prosperous kind of middle-class community directly on the Mississippi River.
1903.
1903, that's right. And had your standard American boyhood at the time. If you read Booth Tarkington and Mark Twain and various people, you get an idea of what the Beiderbecke world must have been like. But as he became interested in the new music, which was kind of tantamount in those days to a kid getting interested in rock and roll today, I suppose, his parents, who were extremely traditional folks, took a rather dim view of this, especially as regarded
I'm sure they did.
its effects on his studies, you know.
Yes, and of course.
They shipped him off, finally, to Lake Forest Academy outside Chicago, where, at least presumably, he would receive greater disciplinary control and have to really buckle down to his studies. Of course, it was a lunacy because Lake Forest was only a quick transit ride from the hotbed of hot music, downtown Chicago.
Sure.
So they couldn't have chosen, in their eyes, a worse, and in history's eyes, a better place to send him.
And of course, that's where he fell in with people like Jimmy McPartland.
Yeah, or they with him, you know.
Yeah, right.
Because as Jimmy once told me, and it really has stuck with me through the years, he said, we always looked upon Bix as a little mysterious because he was so preoccupied, he was wrapped up in this little musical world of his own, and he never quite seemed to be there when you were talking to him. He was always thinking of something else, and that enhanced the aura of almost something mystical about him.
Yeah, I mean, it was really sort of being perpetuated into this kind of legend of mystery, which still goes on today.
Sure.
About him. What else can we play? There's a million tunes to choose from. What do you think would be a good one?
Well, one of Beiderbecke's wonderful associations, probably the most important one, was, of course, with the C Melody saxophone player Frankie Trumbauer. And together, they made a series of records in 1927, which are still unsurpassed for being embodiments of the kind of music they represented. This next tune, which bands, generally speaking, take at a racehorse tempo, they took at a much more leisurely tempo, which is very smart because it brought out elements of the song that nobody dreamt were there. I'm talking about Way Down Yonder in New Orleans.
Who wrote that song, by the way?
I think it was Henry Creamer and Turner Layton, no? And I'm sure that if it's not, you're going to have a barrage of collectors and historians calling up and saying, you should know that somehow.
Yes, will we get that all the time?
Of course.
Well, let's have at it.
Okay.
One, two.
you know, as nice as that tempo was, every so often I was reminded of Jimmy singing that thing the way he used to sing it, you know, with the kind of, he always had that sort of roustabout air. And actually, it was fun hearing that. But something I was wondering, did Bix ever sing?
No, at least not that anybody ever noted. But, you know, apropos Jimmy's singing, I always thought, on the basis of the various vocals I heard him take on gigs and everything, and also his wonderful performance on that Music Man record.
Oh, yeah.
That he had a flair for a certain type of vocal, and in another life, in another world, could have, I think, rather successfully gone after a subsidiary career on the musical stage. Because I have running around in my mind his vocals on, what is it, You Got Trouble in River
oh,
City
yeah.
and all that. And that was not only good, it was superb. It was really good. You know,
I know. Really. I really wanted him to be the Road Company Robert Preston.
He could have done it.
He could have. But, you know, he was, as you know, Jimmy was sort of laid back, and he would rather play golf than knock his brains out trying to do something like that.
Don't let it bother you, kid.
Right. But, of course, I owe Jimmy so many things, but especially introducing me to Bix in a more personal way. I mean, Jimmy gave me the sort of personal aspects of Bix, having known him so well, with all these little side remarks and places they went to hear music. And I guess that's how Jimmy learned all these tunes.
Well, also, I think it's very important to note that because you had this kind of close-up exposure to that tradition, I don't think you'll mind my saying that the lyricism and the kind of sense of emotional coloration does inform a lot of your work in a way that might not have been possible had you not had that exposure.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that kind of harmonic thinking that Bix had has certainly affected me.
Well, I certainly
greatly, all these years.
When I was writing the notes to your album with the strings and everything, you know, I thought a lot about that. I said, well, how many other piano players are there in the world who can deal with colorational layering like this? And, you know, it's something that has always proved both deeply charming and often moving to me.
Listen, you've got to stop this because I'm getting a big head and there's something I have to say here. I should let our listeners know my guest is Richard Sudhalter with guitarist Howard Alden and bassist Bill Crow. I'm Marian McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz, made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. One of the tunes by Bix that I've always loved is Davenport Blues, which I don't know when he wrote it, probably early on for his hometown.
1925, actually.
See, you would know. But you know what would be really nice? I would love to hear you and Howard Alden play Davenport Blues as a duet.
Then let's do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
You know, that's such a nice piece. I don't know, it's very original, isn't it? Like, it's such a nice musical phrase.
But it's his concept, isn't it? You know, that way of phrase building is very similar to what he does on the horn.
Well, and I'm just sort of trying to picture him sitting in his room, or whether he just knocked that off in a hurry, or whether he played it on the horn. You know, you sort of have these little things in your mind wondering how these tunes got.
I don't know, but something Hoagy Carmichael said later on maybe has some bearing here. When somebody was interviewing him and said, you know, how do you write songs, Mr. Carmichael? Hoagy said, I don't write them, I find them. And, you know, it conjured up this idea of a guy sitting in front of a piano keyboard with his hands poised. And then he just kind of comes down on it, and there's the song waiting for him. And, you know, I don't think it's that different in the case of somebody like Bix.
Probably not, because a little melodic idea might start in his head first, or it might start on the piano.
Sure,
first.
Anywhere. Dave Frischberg once said of another very famous Broadway composer, with his melodies, you can almost hear the wheels and the gears whirring around in his mind. But with Hoagy, he was talking about Carmichael at the time, you really get the idea that he just had this idea, and it came out, and he worked it out, and there it was.
Yeah, amazing. And then thinking about Bix and the wonderful piano solos that he wrote, I'm wondering if those would ever have got put down in sheet music if Bill Challis hadn't been around to sort of corral him and say, hey, wait a minute, what did you play there?
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, fellow musicians, colleagues, friends, talked incessantly about the idea that whenever he had a spare moment, Bix would go off and noodle at the piano and everything. But it was only when Challis all but locked him in an apartment, sitting there with a piece of score paper and saying, okay, now, play something, and Bix would play it, and Bill would notate it, and then he'd say, well, do that again, and Bix would do it slightly differently, and Bill said, no, you have to do it the same way, because I can't give the public 14 alternative versions of the way this works. And, of course, it's kind of evokes memories of Maxwell Perkins locking Thomas Wolfe in a similar apartment and saying, I'm not going to open the door until you finish this thing.
Right. Well, the time that I heard Bix playing in a misstep was probably long before it was actually written down, wasn't it? I don't know, 78 years ago?
No, actually, the 78 did surprisingly well for OK Records. And on the strength of that, Robbins Music approached Challis and said, can you get this guy to write some of this stuff out? And, you know, on the one hand, he thought, oh, God, you know, and on the other, he said, sure, of course, you know, naturally I will. And then started the transcription process.
Well, I'm really glad that it got written out, because I don't think I could have picked it out so easily from the record. So luckily I did have the little folio. So I was able to kind of get In a Mist down, if not the others. So I did play Candlelights. I mean, In a Mist, Candlelights, Flashes.
And In the Dark.
And In the Dark.
Well, you know, In a Mist, of course, underwent quite a few changes between the recording and the published version. First, Bix played the recording at a fairly fast tempo because, of course, they had only 3 minutes in which to record it. And so the story goes, Frank Trumbauer, who was in the studio at the time, just tapped him on the shoulder when it was time to wrap it up.
Oh, my God, what an awful thing to do to that tune. Because when I first heard it, I thought, gee, why does he have to play it so fast? It's so melodic, so dreamy, and so pretty.
Well, also, when the published version came out, it had, of course, gained a new strain, that kind of elegiac strain in the middle, which we now know as an indispensable part of the composition. That wasn't on the original record. Exactly, yeah. And which Hoagy Carmichael loved so much that in the 40s tried to turn that into a popular song and even got Paul Francis Webster to write a lyric for it.
That I never knew.
Why don't we hear you playing In a Mist and bringing to it all those wonderful qualities that only you are capable of bringing to it?
All right, I'll try. I'd love to do it. Thank you.
It's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
It really is, and it. I think the essence of the piece, it just has this wonderful, I don't know, it just gives you a good feeling. Just
well, again, it's emotionally a rather complex thing because you've got flashes of all, and I don't mean that as a pun, you've got flashes of all sorts of different kinds of emotions in there. I mean, if everything from jubilation to melancholy, all kind of stratified in most intriguing ways. You can't say this is a happy piece, this is a sad piece, this is one thing or another. It's got all kinds of stuff, making it emotionally rather complex in a way that certainly jazz in the 20s wasn't often. So it's very far ahead of its time that way.
Yeah, and that's one thing I guess people always talk about is that Bix was ahead of his time and what would he be doing if he were alive today? I wonder what kind of music he would be into.
Well, that's the eternal blind alley because, you know, you can say, well, he would have done this, he would have done that. And by dying at 28 in 1931, he, I think, forever asked this tantalizing question.
You know, this is all very interesting, and I'm dying to hear more. But first, I want to remind folks that my guest is Richard Sudhalter with Howard Alden on guitar and Bill Crow on bass. I'm Marion McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz, which is made possible in part by the Baldwin Piano Company.
You know what I'd like to play?
No. What?
You know, Bix recorded, naturally, when he was with Goldcat and Whiteman, a lot of pop tunes, just songs of the 20s that happened to be around. One of my all-time favorites is a thing that he recorded twice, once with Whiteman, once with a little group, in 1928. It's called Louisiana.
Was that a pop tune of the time?
Sure was. In fact, the lyricist on it was Andy Razaf, who collaborated so successfully with Fats Waller and James B. Johnson and all sorts of others. So, with your leave, can we pretty please?
I'd love to do that. It's funny, that's another one of the tunes that I played with Jimmy. It's got a nice melody.
It does.
And we could really do something nice on that.
Then let's do something nice on it.
Okay. Thank you. it's funny, that doesn't seem to me like a pop tune so much as one of the regular traditional jazz repertoire, but I guess that's what it became.
Well, sure, and at the time, in the 20s, bands were snapping up any songs that sounded good, felt good to play and everything, so that you had a combination of such items as, you know, At the Jazz Band Ball and other original material by the musicians, and pop songs, things that simply were on the market, they recorded, and of course, their use delighted the representatives of the music publishing world, who got nice and rich and prosperous on the proceeds.
Boy, I would love to have been around at that time and been able to see and hear all the stuff that Jimmy described so in such a lively way. I mean, I'm really glad that Jimmy and I got together, because through him I was able to learn so much about the music and about those days and clubs they went to, and about him hanging out with Louis Armstrong and hanging out with Bix. I mean, it made such wonderful stuff to listen to.
Well, I think that way the whole era must have come alive for you, because, you know, he not only lived it and witnessed it, he was a very important participant in it. And so you weren't just looking at it from the outside in the manner of somebody viewing the Harlem Renaissance or something like that. You were actually hearing it from somebody who was crucial to it and was inside.
And it's so funny, I never can get over how Bix made such an impression on Jimmy that lasted him a lifetime. I mean, not only as a musician, but as a person and as somebody who befriended him when he replaced Bix in the Wolverines. I guess all that was very important to him.
Well, it's particularly interesting because at the time Jimmy replaced Bix with the Wolverines, there was one of them was perhaps that was 1924, so it means Bix would have been 21 and Jimmy would have been what, 18?
I think he was 17.
17?
I think he said he was 17.
And yet Bix is calling, is saying, "Hey kid, this, and come on kid, you got to learn that." Already the season pro, when you look back on it, and they were both kids.
I know.
In that sense.
It's amazing. And of course, I have to say, Jimmy's favorite phrase that he told to the day he died, Bix saying, "I like you, kid. You sound like me, but you don't play like me.
You don't copy me.
Yeah. Yeah. That really was an important thing in his life, wasn't it? And I guess it's nice that Bix was that important, not only to Jimmy, but to millions of people that heard the music or knew him or met him.
I think it's only a shame that his wider fame only really came along after he was gone. He was written once or twice about in his lifetime, and of course he was a legend among fellow musicians. My father once told me that when the word got around as far away as Boston that Bix was dead, my father said it was like the Pope had died.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was the linchpin. He was the poster boy for the whole kind of Gnostic hot jazz cult, you know, which existed quite apart from all the trappings of the so-called jazz age,
yeah,
which had nothing much to do with the music as we know it.
Well, Rich, we'll have more talk and music in a minute, but first I want to let you know that my guest is Richard Sudhalter, with Howard Alden on guitar and Bill Crow on bass. I'm Marian McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz, which is made possible in part by Borders Books and Music, celebrating the arts by supporting cultural programming on NPR. You know, it would be really fun for me to sort of try to put together a little my thoughts about Bix in music, like a sort of a spontaneous tribute, you might say.
A stream of consciousness.
A stream of consciousness. Could I try that?
Why don't you do it? I'll bet it's going to be gorgeous, and you've now committed yourself to it, so go to it.
All right.
That was, I must tell you, lovely. You somehow captured the essence of that whole mentality, that whole kind of musical worldview that characterizes Bix, and did it as no one else but you could do it.
Actually, I had fun doing it. It's like you can transcend your thoughts onto the keyboard. That's all I can say. I enjoyed doing it. And I'm so glad that we had a chance to get together and play and chat. It's such fun to have you and Howard, Bill Crow, Howard Alden, and do the show. And I really think that with your wonderful way of talking about everything, I mean, you have so much knowledge about Bix that it really gives people listening a good idea.
I hope so.
Of what the man was like.
Well,
and there's one tune of in his repertoire that, again, I learned from Jimmy that I really love, and maybe we could wind up with that. Singing the Blues, could we do that?
Oh, I've been waiting for you to suggest it.
Well, I just did.
Now, I have an idea. Since the Bix solo is so well known, and because I am at heart a very cowardly kind of guy, I would suggest, if Howard has no objection, that Howard Alden play the famous Bix solo first, so that we'll know what Bix did on it. Then perhaps I'll play a chorus, and then you'll play a chorus. And by that time, we will have said pretty much all that needs to be said about Singing the Blues.
I think so. Thank you. Well, I'm sure Bix was listening to us.
I certainly hope so, and especially since his music, I suspect, is going to be around throughout the next century just as it was the previous one.
Oh, yes.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with Marian McPartland. Her guest today has been Richard Sutthalter. Join us each week at this time as Marian welcomes other outstanding artists for conversation and improvisation. Piano Jazz is recorded at Avatar Studios in New York City and is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson. Recording engineer, Richard Applegate. Mastering engineer, David Mitchell. Production manager, Audrey Shiflett. The executive producer is Tom Clark. If you wish to contact us, our email address is pj@scetv.org. Our postal address is 1101 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. To find out more about the artist and music selections heard on Piano Jazz, or to listen to a recent program you may have missed, visit our website, pianojazz.npr.org. Major support for this program was provided by the Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, seeking to enrich community life by supporting the arts, education, and culture, the Joseph Drown Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and prevention of child abuse, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.